Steve invited me to this a while ago, and you know, said, could you come do this? And I thought, gee, let's see, I get to go talk about something that I really like to do to a bunch of people who are interested in hearing what I have to say about it. Where's the catch? You know, this is a nice thing to do. So, and it seemed like it would be fairly easy because I've been teaching statistics for a long time, so I'll tell you about it in a little while. And I didn't think a whole lot about it until it came fairly close time to come out here, and then I sat down and said, okay, I should make up some, you know, some slides for presentation. And it turned out doing that was a lot harder than I expected, because I've been teaching for a long time, and people seem to react relatively favorably when I do it, so I guess I've done something all right with it, but I don't know what I do exactly. I've never really thought very systematically about what it is that I do and how I put these things together, and so the preparation for this workshop here is probably the first time that I've given straightforward, systematic thought for more than 2 or 3 minutes about this whole thing. So it was a very useful exercise for me as well. I'm not sure that what I say here is going to be the final word on what I do here, so and it may even develop a little bit as we go along. So what I thought I would do is just, as Steve said, tell you a bit about my experiences with teaching, things that I think I've discovered over the years in teaching methodology, what works for me, what doesn't work for me so well, and maybe some tips and tricks if those come along a little bit. And if we have time at the end of me getting done here, I can actually show you some of these some examples of the things that I talk about. So one of the things that I like to teach very much is graphics, statistical graphics and graphical approaches to statistics. And I like using dynamic graphics to show things. So I've got a couple of examples of that if anybody would like to see them. One of the things that I'll talk about is that I try to integrate a website fairly closely into the classes that I do. So if you're interested, we can take a look at a website that I created for a class that I taught for the last time in the spring of 2008, but I will be teaching again in the spring of 2013. So it's very heavily on my mind here. And anyway, we can see examples of the things that I'm trying to talk about here today. So I hope I can back up any claims that I make and give you some details on things that maybe you find interesting. What I thought I would first do is be narcissistic about this a bit and let you know a little bit about where I come from, what my background is, how I get to call myself a methodologist and particularly a statistics teacher here. And of course, as with anybody else's career development, it's a combination of training and experience and more than a little bit of luck in the way things go, luck and coincidence. So in terms of training, you know, I began as a political scientist and started as a political science undergraduate. That's not true. I actually started as an English literature undergraduate. So I didn't come perhaps naturally to this sort of thing to begin with. I figured out pretty quickly that English lit, as much as I loved it, was not going to get me very far in terms of financial remuneration. I thought, well, gee, I want to become a lawyer. So lawyers, political science majors. Political science majors are lawyers. So I'll go do that. And at the University of Delaware, there was a requirement that all freshman political science majors had to go talk to the department chair. And, of course, to a naive freshman coming in, the department chair was this godlike figure who I met with this one time and never talked to again. But this man changed my life, although he didn't realize that he did it. I went in and sat down to this very forbidding figure. His name was William Boyer, and I don't know anything else about him other than that. But he sort of looked at me gruffly, and he said, political science major, what do you want to do? I said, well, I want to be a lawyer, sir. And he said, no, there are too many lawyers. You don't want to do that. So he looked at my record and my scholastic aptitude tests. He said, you have high math SATs here. I said, yeah, you know, I've always enjoyed that. He said, okay, you're going to do empirical political theory, and we're going to hook you up with this guy. And I said, okay, you know, we have the best guy in the country in empirical political theory. Yes, sure, why not? I had no idea what he was talking about, but the guy he hooked me up with became one of my early heroes and my undergraduate advisor. So I was at the University of Delaware. This guy's name was H.D. Reynolds. H.D. Reynolds, Hank Reynolds, was a student of a sociologist named Hubert Blaylock. Does the name Blaylock mean anything to anybody anymore? The reason I say this is because one of my graduate students, quite a few years ago now, came in and said, you know, I found this book by some guy named Blaylock or something like that. Like, you never heard of him? No, never heard of him. This is Blaylock was, of course, a major figure. He was probably, this is a little bit of an exaggeration, but more than anybody else, he could claim to introduce quantitative methods in social sciences in the late 1950s, particularly in the early 1960s. Hank Reynolds was one of his last graduate students at the University of North Carolina. Blaylock worked in what we nowadays call structural equation models, simultaneous equation models. Then we called it causal analysis or path analysis. And Hank was interested in applying path analytical principles to nominal and ordinal data. And he's a phenomenal person. I wouldn't be just like this guy. You know, I mean, personally and professionally. He's certainly my role model. He was very generous of his time and his experience. The first time my name ever appeared in print was due to him. He was one of the authors of one of the very first Little Green Sage books. You know, everybody knows the Quas series there. There was the original output was a set of seven of those that came out in 1977, and Hank wrote the one on the analysis of nominal data. And he asked me to read it for him, you know, to proofread it and so on. And, of course, I was flabbergasted that he would want me to do such a thing. And, of course, went out of my way to really do an excellent job with that. And he thanked me, and I thought this was the coolest thing in the world. So it was really very nice. But this guy had a profound effect on me. And I had some other people who were important there. One that Tom James and Dennis Winger were still are sociologists. Back in those days, I think it's fair to say that quantitative methods were more fully developed and probably more fully accepted in sociology than they were in political science at that point. So these guys in the sociology department were heavily influential to me when I was an undergraduate. They were desperately happy to have anybody who was interested in doing statistics in those days. So they glommed onto me pretty quickly, just as I did onto them. But another political scientist who influenced me very heavily was Guy Peters, comparative policy person, who I know Chris knows. Nowadays, I don't think most people would think of Guy as a quantitative political scientist at all, but in the late 1960s, he very definitely did. He was one of the very, very few who did this kind of work then, and he was very, very influential in me, to me. And the funny thing was, Guy and Hank were both trying to influence me to go to graduate school. Guy had just left Michigan State. He graduated from Michigan State, got his PhD there, so he wanted me to go to Michigan State, and Hank wanted me to go to North Carolina, and I wanted to go to North Carolina to study with Blaylock, and initially North Carolina had a good sense not to accept me, and then Michigan State did. So I got in there, and I was going to go to Michigan State, and then at the last minute, North Carolina let me in, so I ended up going to UNC, and it took me, 35 more years to get back to Michigan State. But I went down there to study with Hubert Blaylock, only to find that Blaylock wasn't there anymore, which I don't know whose letdown was with that, but I was kind of unhappy about that when I first got there, but I lucked out. I mean, everything worked out in the end, and I think the way things worked out even better. I had an advisor who, I can't tell you how much I think of this guy, he's the smartest person I have ever known anywhere under any circumstances. It's George Rabinowitz. George Rabinowitz, those of you who are in political science, voting behavior in particular, he's probably best known for his work on the directional theory of issue voting, an alternative to Gamzee and proximity model and so on. But George did a lot of other things besides that. George was a wonderful, absolutely beautiful person, as well as the smartest person I've ever known. George passed away a little over a year ago, about a year and a half ago now, which was a terrible tragedy in all sorts of ways. I'm actually putting on a conference in his honor in about a month and a half now, so hopefully we can keep some of the work that he did alive. George was a role model in all of the best possible ways, in the quality of his scholarship, in the stringency of the standards that he brought to his work, and as I said, just in terms of, in general, being a really, really smart guy. So more than anybody else, he's the person that really influenced me, and I think made me whatever I am today, for better or for worse, I suppose. But other people who influenced me there as well, there was another political scientist there named Martin Zechman. And Marty actually taught most of the statistics courses that I took in the political science department. He's since left academia. He got kind of frustrated with things. Marty's claim to fame in political science is that he was the first political scientist to publish a Bayesian article, an article using Bayesian statistics. It appeared in Public Choice back in 1985. Again, a very, very smart man, very, very nice guy, but making an awful lot more money than any of us are ever going to make in our life in the insurance industry. Another person who was hugely influential on me, but who was not a political scientist, was Forrest Young. Forrest Young was a very, very important psychometrician. He made critical contributions to the development of a set of methods called multidimensional scaling. And that's one of my interests. It was one of George Benowitz's interests as well. And Forrest was right across the street from us. And so he got me involved in that. Very influential also in terms of his thinking on statistical graphics was a big development there. This guy, William Reynolds, you've never heard his name. I absolutely know you haven't. It turns out he was the brother of my undergraduate advisor. A strange story. These two guys, neither one graduated from high school. They both got kicked out of high school. They didn't talk to each other for many, many years. One went in the Peace Corps. The other was told, if you don't go in the Army, you're going to go to jail. So they didn't see each other. And then one day in 1966, they were walking down Franklin Street in Chapel Hill. They each saw each other and said, what are you doing here? And they said, simultaneously, they said, I'm here to start political science graduate school. And we asked them, is this true? And they said, yes, it is. But Bill didn't finish his political science degree. He became a computer programmer. And in fact, he was one of the first programmers to work for SPSS. He actually worked for Norman Nye back when Nye owned SPSS. He did a number of things for SPSS. These are the days, of course, when there were no PCs. These are long before PC days. These are mainframe days. Bill wrote, among other things, their first scatterplot routine. And this is the mainframe line printers and so on. I mentioned him because he taught me how to program. He was the person who influenced me in terms of computer programming, taught me that, believe it or not, computer programming is actually fun. It can be a distraction from other academic pursuits because it involves different sorts of thinking. There are different kinds of criteria that determine what's a good program and things like this. And, of course, you tell people that you actually find programming fun and enjoyable as a distraction to other work, and they know you what kind of a geek you really are. But nevertheless, that's pretty productive, too, and Bill really had a big influence on me. Stuart McDonald. Of course, collaborator in all kinds of ways with George Benowitz, another person who affected me a lot. I was also very, very fortunate at North Carolina in that there were public institutions there, one that was very useful for me, the Institute for Research and Social Science, which is now the Odom Institute, Howard Odom Institute for Research and Social Science, a multidisciplinary research center that, among other things, gave us a computing center for the social sciences. And again, we're talking about the middle to late 1970s here, when we're talking mostly mainframes, very few PCs. This was the friendly computer center on campus where you had to deal with the kids taking the intro to computer science courses and things like that. If you wanted somebody who actually spoke English and at the same time knew about computer programs, this is where you came. I had most of my teaching assistantships there. So I spent much of my graduate school teaching assistant career teaching courses on things like SPSS, research design, things like this, very, very early on. Worked for a time on what we then called the user service desk, which is essentially meant we sat there all day, and anybody with computer programming questions would come in and ask them for us. And, you know, we had a really good reputation here that, you know, like I said, we spoke English rather than Fortran, and we would solve the problem for you. And what was so cool about this was I learned more doing that, I think, in terms of research methods than I did just about any place else, because you never knew what the next question was going to be, what discipline it was coming from, whether it was going to involve methodology or programming or what type of methodology. So it really, really taught me to be very, very quick on my feet. And then there's another organization there called the L.L. Thurstone Psychometrics Laboratory. This is where Forrest Young worked. I didn't have any assistantships there, but certainly did a lot of work and learned a lot from the people that I dealt with there. So over time, this training was really, really helpful. Again, I said there's a lot of luck involved here. One of the pieces of luck that was involved was that my friend Bill Reynolds was not only involved with SPSS, he was one of the people who worked with the founders of SAS. None of you probably use SAS anymore, but back in the 1970s, SAS was the R of the day. And if you wanted to show what a really hot methodologist you were, you turned your nose up at SPSS, which is really the only other alternative, and said, oh, I use SAS for all that. And SAS is from Cary, North Carolina, which is right close to Chapel Hill, so it was very convenient, and Bill actually got me a job with SAS. So I learned a lot more about programming there, too, so that was very, very helpful. So I think I was well-trained. I was lucky. Again, I went to study with Blaylock. Blaylock wasn't there, but fortunately there was a guy there that more than made up for Blaylock not being there, so I was off to a really, really good start. Luck is backed up by experience. I've been very fortunate in my professional career so far. I started off, my first teaching was at the University of Missouri and Ohio State University, and these are the years from 1980 through 1989. Got my my first methods teaching experience, not as opposed to short courses I taught at UNC, got my first experience with my own courses at these institutions. And oddly enough, the first teaching that I did was relatively advanced methodology courses. So, of course, you come out of graduate school, and I've just learned that I'm one of these hotshot quantitative types, and there were even fewer of them then than there are now, but there really weren't very many. So you get your new job, and you go in there thinking you're the king of the world, and I'm going to, you know, I know how to teach this stuff, and so I'm going to let me teach your stat courses, and we'll really show these students what to do. And, you know, there were a couple of older faculty members who've been teaching the stat courses for a long time. And it took me a while to realize they didn't necessarily like the young guy coming in and saying, oh, I know how to teach statistics here when, you know, you guys don't know how to do this. So now that I'm a senior faculty member, young guys are coming in, I understand how my older colleagues felt in those days. But in any event, I didn't get to teach much of the intro stuff. I got started with a number of advanced courses at these years. I got my initial training there, again, in advanced training. I shouldn't say training. My experience in the classroom with this during these time periods here in relatively advanced courses, which it turns out is a good thing, I think. I think the fact that I was getting students at the advanced level here when I was a pretty inexperienced teacher, it was a self-selection process that took place at that point. We had people who were only taking the advanced courses, which meant that they wanted to learn this stuff, which meant that they were willing to put up with the silly arrogance of a young idiot like me, and it was a pretty gentle introduction to some stuff that's very, very difficult to teach well, so that was a good thing. Around about this time, I just on a whim wrote to the director of the ICPSR summer program, who's a guy named Hank Heidewitt, and I said, gee, you know, I don't get to teach enough statistics here. I want to teach methods courses, and I hear you guys have this program here, which I never went to. I never participated in the summer programs for this one. But, you know, would you let me come teach here? And because Hank was a good friend of George Benowitz's, he said, sure, why don't you come here and teach here? So from 1984 through 1987, I've been teaching in the ICPSR summer program. Taught a scaling course most of that time. I guess that's the one that's really my course. But over the years, I've also taught at different levels their regression classes, from their intro regression class to their advanced regression class, and a number of other things as well. Statistical graphics, there was one time I taught a causal inference course in a variety of different things. As Steve said, you don't get to teach in the ICPSR summer program unless you teach really well. Whether I did or not is not for me to say, but I certainly saw lots of other people who did teach really well in the summer program. These were people who were and remain role models to me in terms of how to do good teaching. Some of the stuff that I really learned is just through watching these people teach, because they're so good at what they do. I was at the University of South Carolina from 1982 through 2002, so much longer. I'm still shocked whenever I realize I've lived in South Carolina longer than I've lived anyplace else in my life. Hopefully I didn't pick up too much of the accent while I was there. Certainly not the social attitudes that were predominant there. The thing that makes this significant for me as an instructor in quantitative methods is because for 13 of those 14 years, I taught a three-course statistics sequence for them. In almost every year, I taught the introductory statistics course, the second course, which was basically an introductory linear models course, and the third course, which the nature of which changed over time. Initially, the third course was what we would now call a structural equation models course, and then over time, it became more and more a maximum likelihood course, a generalized linear models course, so it varied a little bit. But this is really, over all those years, where I could refine my teaching, where I could refine my thinking about teaching, and I would have these students, actually a fairly sizable number of students for the first two semesters, which they were required to take, and I always thought it was a fairly interesting thing that a lot of these people came in not liking what they were doing, but they stayed on for the third non-required course as well. So I assume I was at least duping them in some way that got them into doing it, whether it was effective or not. So a lot of what you're going to be hearing me talk about here comes from the experience that I had teaching these courses during the time that I was there. I've been at Michigan State from 2003 degree up until now, and I don't teach the full sequence anymore. I have not taught the introductory statistics course most of the time at Michigan State. Instead, I taught the second course. I've been teaching the second course, the Introduction to Linear Models course, up through 2000. I said 2003 through 2007. It was actually through 2008, and then I'm scheduled to teach it again in 2013. And I'll teach a bunch of other advanced courses there too. But most of the examples that I'm going to be talking about are not from the basic introductory course. They're from this linear models course, this introductory linear models course that I teach, which is a combined graduate and undergraduate course. Usually there are more graduate students in it, but undergraduates can take it as well. And every year that I've taught it at MSU, there has been a significant number of undergraduates. If I were teaching this to undergraduates, I wouldn't do much different from what I do now. So I think it fits in very nicely with the themes that we're doing here. Just to complete all this, they couldn't get rid of me at the summer program any other way, so when the director retired in 2007, they asked me to take over. I've been director of the summer program since then. Again, as I said before, the reason I mention this here is not to talk about my own position, but about the fact that now I really have to think about the quality of teaching even more systematically than I ever did before. So each year when I decide who's going to be coming back to teach in the summer program, I have to very carefully evaluate what they've done, how they do it, and how people react to it. And once again, I don't feel at all hesitant to say these are the best methodology teachers I have ever seen in my life, these people here. They are incredible at what they do, how they do it, and how effective they are at conveying very advanced, difficult material to people. The one thing that makes them a little bit different from general methods teaching experiences is that the ICPSR summer program is a self-selected audience. You don't have people there who don't want to be there. So part of the reason they're so good, the main reason is because they are good teachers, but you can be even better teacher when you're teaching to the converted, you know, when you're preaching to the choir there and you're there who are they're talking to people who are only there because they want to hear what you have to say. It brings out the best in all of us. So it's helped me understand what makes for good methods teaching. But again, it's not the same kind of methods teaching that you do at home. I mean, my own example here, I the scaling course that I taught for many years and still teach now and again in the summer program. When I teach it at my home institutions, it is a very, very different class, and in my own opinion, doesn't go as well when I teach it at the home institution as when I do in Ann Arbor. And when I say home institution, because I've taught it at South Carolina, at Michigan State, and at Ohio State, and in each of those cases, it just didn't develop the same momentum, the same energy that I get when I do it in Ann Arbor. So that really does make a huge difference in the quality of the class and the way things go. So that's where I come from. That's what I do. I have no specific training as a teacher. I never took education classes. I never even took a workshop on how to do teaching until I didn't take it so much as sit in on one after I'd been a teacher for 30 years. So, of course, I figured I knew more than the instructor did anyway when I was doing that. And when I came out, I had to admit I did learn some things there. But the point is, I never got taught how to teach. And when I've talked to other people who I think are good teachers in particular, and I've tried to get people, we do have a little seminar and summer program on teaching statistics, and when I've tried to get various of my instructors to do this, most of them say, I don't know what to tell you. I have no idea. I don't know what I do here. So I think that's maybe telling. Not so much because I think that way, but because lots of other people that I think are really good teachers aren't sure what they do. They do it through a combination of intuition and experience, learning what does work and what doesn't work. So with that, as we begin to talk about my ideas about teaching, let me give the disclaimer at the beginning that I'm going to tell you what works for me, and I know this is not necessarily what works for a lot of other people. So I'll tell you my hard and fast rules here, which are hard and fast and only so far as the limits of my own classroom go. I think other people do it completely differently than I do. My spouse, for example, teaches the same Introduction to Linear Models course that I teach at Michigan State. She teaches it at the ICPSR summer program, and she and I have very different ideas about how we do it. So it's very much the case that what works for one won't necessarily work for the other. But I will tell you what works for me and what I think about this stuff and what I'm looking at here. So to start with, I approach the class with some assumptions about the students of the class. And again, now I am not talking about the ICPSR summer program. I'm not talking about the advanced statistics courses. I'm talking about primarily the second course in the sequence, the linear models class, but it would basically apply as well to the first course, the introduction to statistics course that I haven't taught recently. Let me mention something here that doesn't show up in the slides anywhere, but I want to tell you this. I don't believe it is possible to teach statistics in a single academic term. When I hear of graduate programs or even undergraduate programs that have a one-class methodology requirement, I know this is a program that's not serious about that. It is impossible to do it. I do not believe that you can get in a single term from nothing, that is, assuming people know nothing about statistics or probability or anything like that, through multiple regression analysis. But nevertheless, dozens of people tell me they can do this, that this is how they teach this. Oh yeah, I start off and we go through research design for the first half of the course, and by the end of the course, I talk multiple regression. Yeah, right. I don't believe that for a moment. To me, the ideal, and it's probably no coincidence that this is the way it's happened with me, one semester is devoted to basic introduction to descriptive statistics, probability, and statistical inference. And even that's a lot. If this were a statistics sequence, you wouldn't cover all that. A statistics sequence in a stat department, you wouldn't cover that. But I certainly think in political science, that's pushing things a little bit to get through that much, but you've got to have that. You can't go much farther than that in the first semester. Then in the second semester, the second term, that's where you get into linear models. That's where you get into really aggressively dealing with questions about relationships between variables and multivariate structure in data. Get them through that, and I know various people think differently about the role of traditional regression analysis in modern research, but I think people have to learn that whole before they can really learn anything else. I think that is the keystone right there, and that's the course that I like to teach at that point. So this is the kind of assumption that I have about the material, which we'll go on and talk about. But I also come in with some assumptions about the students. So the most important thing to remember is that these are social scientists. They are not statisticians. And most of them do not want to be methodologists as social scientists. So as excited as I get about statistical methods and as important as I think they are, it was a shocking discovery to me that most of my students didn't share my enthusiasm that way. And as time has gone on and as the disciplines have become more sophisticated, that still remains the case. No matter what anybody else tells you, most people don't really care about this stuff as much as I do, and as much as we all probably do since we're in a setting like this. Most of the people in these classes are motivated by substantive concerns and issues, not by the beauty of mathematics or the quality of statistics. Most are taking the class because it's required. In many cases, they wouldn't be there if they didn't have to be. They would much rather be doing other things than taking your statistics course. You might be able to encourage some of them to pursue further classes in methodology. I always feel like each one I get to do that is a victory on my part, but my original assumption is that most of them won't, which enhances my responsibility in the whole thing, because they're not going to go much farther beyond my classes here. This is probably it, as far as it goes. What they're going to do, the quality of the research skills that they're going to pick up are very heavily dependent upon what I give them in this class, or what I expose them to in this class. So I know it really gave me pause early on when I started thinking about this to realize how important it was my own orientation to these things here. Of course, we assume that people do not have much of a background in statistics or any of the related concerns like data processing or mathematics or anything like that. What I do assume is familiarity with basic algebra. I tell people, if you don't know basic algebra, we're gonna have a little bit of difficulty here, and you might want to think about getting some background training before you take this course here. It turns out that at least in the U.S., most people have had a basic algebra course, often in secondary school. It's been years since they've had it, but most of them don't forget it entirely, and I can help bring them up to speed in the class as far as things go. I know I'm always amazed, you hear the media talk about, oh, we're in the new technological generation, this computer-savvy generation of young people. They know more about these things than we do. No, they don't. Most of the people have had no use of computers for any sort of systematic data processing. They use computers for social networking, they use it for word processing, they use it for gaming and accessing the web. They have never done any data analysis whatsoever. So the notion that people are becoming more sophisticated, we don't have to teach them how to compute, is, in my experience at least, dead wrong. One of the things that it was a shocker to me as I was beginning to learn how to teach is that it's so important to take into consideration the student's own orientations to the class. So there are some easy elements about this, and the easiest and the nicest element about it is that most of the students coming into the class really are curious about what they're going to learn there. They have no idea what this material is about, and they really do want to do well in the class. So fortunately, that's the primary orientation. I wasn't so sure about that first few classes that I taught, but I think I feel fairly safe in saying that. Most people really do want to learn the material. Now, the problem is there are the difficult parts of student motivation, student background here. There are a lot of people who are very nervous about the material, and I mean really nervous. It wasn't the first year, but it was one of the first years that I taught. I had an adult male start crying in my class. I mean, this was disconcerting. I didn't know how to react to it. The reason he started crying was I mentioned calculus, which we don't use. And so, you know, this guy probably had some other issues as well. Maybe his parents beat him with integral signs or something like that. But he was an extreme. But really, a lot of these people really are afraid of this material, really just terror-stricken by it. I think this notion of math phobia is grossly over-exaggerated. It's grossly exaggerated, and the degree to which it exists is grossly overestimated. But these people think they feel this. So unfortunately, a lot of them find out they aren't as fearful as they really said that they were. Where the problems arise is that some of them are hostile when they come in there. They don't want to be there. They don't want you wasting their time. Damn it, I don't want to, I got better things to do here. And of course, I got hostile back the first few years that we taught. That's not a good thing to do. But it took me a while to find that out. And the way I found it out was, of course, to understand what the base of the hostility is. It's the fact that these people are, anxious, scared, insecure about what's going on. And, of course, as soon as I realized that, I began putting the hostility into perspective, and I think can deal with it a little more effectively than I ever have in the past. One of the reasons for hostility and a sort of motivating factor for everybody is that they are afraid of looking stupid, both toward me and, more importantly, in front of their peers. So one of the most important things that I do is keep telling people, I know they still don't believe me because they don't react the way I want them to, but I keep telling them there is no such thing as a stupid question here. Don't ever feel that way. Whenever you have a question, if you're hesitant to ask it, don't be, because I guarantee you at least one other person in this class has exactly the same question in mind, and he or she is afraid to ask it. So, you're doing not only yourself, but the class a favor by asking the questions here. Do they believe me? Probably not. But at least I get people asking questions sometimes. So even if it works a little bit, it's fairly good. Another one of the things that took me a long time to understand is that these people are afraid of us. These are graduate students. And, when I was a young guy and I was basically their same age, I couldn't understand they were afraid of me. Aaron's excited about this stuff, and you should be excited about it too. And they not only weren't excited about it, they were afraid of me, or at least intimidated about this. So, I think I've become more effective when I realize this, and then just keep that in the back of my mind when I go into the teaching there. And don't let it go to my head either. So, I don't like intimidating people very much. One of the things I try to keep in mind is, what do I want students to get? What do I want students to do? What do I want them to come out of my course with? And this, too, took a long time to put it into perspective. First of all, realizing I'm not going to turn them all into methodologists. As much as I'd like to, as much as I'd like them all coming out doing first-class, high-quality, quantitative work, and not only that, but contributing to our knowledge of quantitative methodology, most of them aren't going to do that. So getting that into my head was one of the big lessons of my early teaching career. What I try to do instead is convey basic skills, teach them some basic data processing and basic statistical concepts, basic statistical techniques. I want to foster an appreciation for statistics. I want people to understand why this stuff is useful, what it can contribute to, and how it can help us in what we do. And I want to give them, of course, enough information that they can use statistical tools in relatively straightforward substantive problems. So again, I'm not going to create experts here. I'm not going to create people who can deal with any, you know, situation that arises, but given a standard data set that they've gotten from ICPSR or some other standard data source, they should be able to do at least straightforward, reasonable statistical analysis with that by the time they come out of my class, assuming that they keep up with the class and do the work and so on. And of course, in the back of my head, what I want to do is find those people for whom I can stimulate their interest into learning more and going farther. And again, I'm happy to say that just about every time I teach this course, there's at least one, and usually more than one. So it seems to work. It seems to catch on, and it seems to be doing what I expect it to do. Some more objectives here. Keep in mind that we want our students to be producers and consumers of statistical methods. They need to learn basic concepts and these fundamental principles and fundamentals of techniques so they can understand the literature that they read. But I firmly believe that the only way they can do that is with some experience on the, what I call on the production side, of actually doing data analysis. You cannot learn this stuff fully passively. When I started teaching my first academic job at the University of Missouri Political Science Department had a requirement for a quote-unquote defensive statistics course, that all they required their graduate students to do was learn defensive statistics as opposed to offensive statistics. You know, that was the obvious retort. And again, those same older guys who were teaching the methods classes didn't find it very funny when I said that. They probably never heard it before. But their notion was they could teach people statistics as consumers with absolutely no need to get your hands dirty and do the work. I don't believe it. I don't believe that's possible. I think you do have to get your hands dirty, doing a little bit of data analysis, and even have a rudimentary appreciation for what these methods and what these approaches can do. And, you know, of course, hopefully some exposure and some encouragement can get people to use it in their own work as well. But the important thing is, and this is the phrase I always use, learning statistics is not a spectator sport. You can't do it that way. You're going to have to do some work. And this is one of the ideas that I start pushing from the very first few minutes of the first day of this of this class, that you're going to be doing work in here. Get used to it. It's not going to hurt you. You actually, you know, might find out that you learned something and find something that you enjoy here. Now, the format for the class, the type of class that I do, and you're basically seeing it here, in a sense, the way I'm talking here. My classes are primarily lectures. You know, we're talking about a subject matter here that discussion formats, you know, seminar-type discussion formats don't work so well. There's a certain body of information that people have to get and comprehend before you can start thinking about discussion things. So I really do take a primarily lecture approach. But that being said, I tell people that questions are always encouraged. Remember what I said a moment ago, you know, don't ever think you're going to ask a stupid question. There's no such thing, and everybody else has questions. You know, take the lead and ask the questions, and they'll get less afraid, too. So what I want is, before we get to that, what I want is what I call active lectures or participatory lectures. I'm up there lecturing, but I try to get people to just break in and talk and ask things. They don't have to put their hands up, and don't worry, the worst I'm going to do is say, hang on, we're going to get to that in a few minutes, or let me finish this and then we'll come back to that. But really sort of encourage to the greatest extent possible a willingness to speak up while I'm still lecturing there. So it's not give and take in the sense of that sort of thing, but it's something that does encourage some interaction at different intervals throughout the course of an individual class. As far as computing is concerned, I keep that for separate lab sessions, and I'll talk about the role of computing in my classes here, but for the most part, we don't do computing in the class. I've actually team taught with some people, and I have had my team, you know, the other people on my team stand up there and do very fancy things in Stata or R or whichever software we're using, and I look around and I see the whole class going like this, and I'm kind of going like that too. And remember, I'm the geek who actually enjoys programming, so I keep this as separate. Lab sessions for computing, that's a different context. I don't want that in my classroom. I want that separate. So it's a conscious decision on my part to keep it separate, despite the fact that computing is an integral part of what I do in the second session class. We'll come back to that as well. one of the things that's important for me, before every exam, I hold a review session. So set aside 2-3 hours, put it at, find out what is the best time for the class. It's often an evening. I tell them I'd love to take them out for a beer, but since the exam is the next day, I don't want you drinking the night before, so at least not drinking excessively. But again, it's an outside context. It's not in the regular classroom. And my spiel for this is, you can ask me anything you want, except for, is this on the exam? Because what you should assume is, if we covered it in class, it's on the exam. But any substantive question whatsoever, and they do. They come in with lots of questions, and these review sessions, I don't know about them, actually I do, because I can see it, the way they talk and the way they think and the way they act and react to me. They're fun. I mean, this is a neat way to interact with people, because we're not in a lecture setting. They're working with me in there, and so I think these review sessions, they sort of become a tradition, and they have become a very, very important part of the class. Regular office hours goes without saying. Be there for people. You often won't get a lot of people to come, but the fact that you're sitting there with your office door open, they notice that, even if they don't come in there. And so I think that's an absolutely critical thing. Another absolutely critical thing is a website for the class. And I suspect the website is part of the reason that I don't have people coming into my office hours, because a lot of what they would ask me about or ask me for is already available on the website. So I think that's really pretty critical there. The other thing that's important for me, and I mention this here realizing that a lot of people don't have the resources that this is going to be available to them, but I can't tell you how important having a good teaching assistant is, having somebody working with you in the class. I have found that this is almost as critical as anything that I do as an instructor in a class here. So when I have a teaching assistant, and of course I try to make sure that it's one of my students and somebody that's already working with me, it's not always the case, but these are the people that are responsible for checking and correcting homework assignments, which we'll talk about in greater detail as we go on. I ask them to listen to my lectures and create outlines of the topics that I cover in the lectures. Not complete covers. These are not lecture notes. What I want them to do is just list the topics that I cover in the lectures, and then we put those up on the website so people can see what they should have gotten. And of course, I review these outlines before they go up on the website there. These people give assistance with computing. Sometimes, depending upon the particular individual, they may give lab sessions on their own. Otherwise, it might just be individual one-on-one help. And of course, these people have regular office hours and general assistance when his or her colleagues are taking the same classes that they are, too. So, the normal sorts of things that a teaching assistant would do. But what I keep emphasizing, both to the students in the class, to the teaching assistant, and to my colleagues in the department, is that this person is an integral part of the instructional team for this class. It's not just my class, it's that person's in my class together. They are as responsible for the class as, well, I can't say that, but they're important for the material that gets conveyed. First of all, obviously, reduces the work for me. I don't have to worry about doing homework assignments, which is wonderful. That's the most onerous task as far as I'm concerned. This person provides another interface between the course material and the students. And remember I said the students are intimidated by and sometimes fearful of me? Well, of course, they're not that intimidated by people who are their graduate colleagues. So this bothered me a lot at first. Again, particularly when I was closer to the age of the students that I was teaching. Gee, why don't they come to me? I don't see these people here. They go to, whoever it was who's my teaching assistant. Well, get the perspective that a few years' experience gives you. Well, duh, of course. This is somebody they're not afraid of. So that's very good. And then, the nice thing is, I can talk to the teaching assistant and find out what the students are saying. Not so much saying about me or anything like that, but I can get a better sense talking to the teaching assistant about what the students are getting, and more importantly, what they're not getting, what I need to modify, what I need to cover in greater detail in class, and so on. So this notion that this teaching assistant is really part of the instructional team, it's the back and forth flow of communication that this person is involved in, and I think really helps determine what the class is. Now, switch gears a little bit. When I teach statistics, when I took my first stat classes, I really came away with kind of an irritated feeling. This is stat classes from the statistics department at the University of Delaware. And I came away from those classes thinking, I didn't like this here. And I realized that part of the reason was I didn't know what it was all about. It seemed like each class I would get hit with new formulas, I would get hit with new mathematical rules that I was expected to deal with, and you know, I didn't know what I was supposed to do with them or anything like that. And I started thinking, you know, well, you know, these students that are intimidated and fearful and unhappy with the fact that they have to take my classes, maybe they're reacting to that same sort of experience. Maybe they had those kinds of experiences in the past themselves. So, the way I try to deal with this, I certainly don't want that kind of atmosphere in my classroom. I don't want one of these things where, oh God, we're going to go in and Jacoby's going to give us a bunch of new equations this week and I have no idea what they're supposed to be used for and how they relate to what I did before or what I'm going to do next week. I don't want that kind of feeling. So I spend a lot of time talking about what is statistics and what do we do with statistics. And I keep referring back to this throughout the semester, throughout the term, and relating whatever we're doing each day back to this big picture of what is statistics. So, we don't have a whole lot of time to talk about it here, but basically, I say statistics is about variance. Well, you know, that's exactly what science is about. Science doesn't care about things that don't vary, things that don't differ with each other. Science is only concerned with why things in the world around us are different from each other. And that's what statistics looks like. And I give a long explanation about how modern science wouldn't have developed without statistical thinking. In fact, statistical thinking underlies much of the structure of the Western world these days, and so on and so forth. If you read about the history of statistics, it's actually pretty fascinating. You can make a pretty strong argument for these kinds of things. So even some of the normative theory types who were most vociferous in their dislike of the class, they kind of get into this stuff, and it's fun to spend a little bit of time talking about it. I talk about how statistics involves constructing models. And so what's a model? Well, a model is a simplified representation of some object. And, you know, to males in class, I can, you know, unfortunately sexist associations here, you know, when you were a little kid, you built models of airplanes, right? Well, you know, a model airplane isn't a real airplane. It's a simplified representation of an airplane. That's what a model is. What we're talking about are simplified representations of politics and society. But a good model, which is, of course, the only kinds of models we want to do, are those models that focus on the important elements of whatever it is you're modeling and de-emphasize the less important elements. So that's all we're doing with statistics. We're constructing model airplanes. We're constructing little airplanes and big airplanes. It's just here, rather than airplanes, we're constructing little worlds of politics from big worlds of politics. And the nice thing about it is we can pick out just the important parts and shove aside the less important parts. Basically, that's what statistics is. What we're doing too, and this is one of the other ideas that I have to get across to people, is the notion that statistical models are aimed at representing aggregates and groups of observations, not individual objects. I had a colleague at the University of South Carolina, actually a pretty eminent political scientist named Betty Glad, passed away about a year or so ago. She's one of the first women to earn a PhD in political science in the United States. But Betty was definitely not a quantitative political scientist, very much the opposite. And she and I would have these professional banters, and you know, we talk about these things here. And she'd say, well, you know, you try to represent these groups of things. I'm not interested in that. I'm interested in what makes each individual different from every other individual. She was a scholar of the American presidency. I said, no, I incorporate that in my work too. That's there when I do statistics. She said, wow, could it be? And I said, we call it the error term. She didn't find that very funny. But in fact, it's true. And you know, I bring this up in class, and I try to explain to people that this is exactly the case. We're not looking for the idiosyncrasies. The idiosyncrasies which maybe idiosyncratic from a scientific modeling perspective can in fact be enormously interesting from a humanistic perspective. Or to a historian or to somebody else. So they are there, it's just that's not what we're looking at here. So again, this is you know, the first couple of class meetings you're talking about these things and give people a context to think about things. I talked about the fact that statistical models are quantitative representations. You know, for those of you who don't like math, sorry about that. You're going to have to deal with some here, but math ain't so bad as you'll find out. And what I usually say is that the objectives of a statistical model generally come down to two things. You know, phrased differently by different people, and I certainly am not sure I phrase it any better than anybody else does. But essentially to me, one of the questions that we deal with statistics, use statistics to deal with, is the question of whether we can represent the most interesting basic characteristics of some phenomenon using a small set of descriptive quantities. Can we take, you know, this buzzing, blooming confusion of reality around us here and reduce that, reduce the essence of it, distill it down to a small set of descriptive quantities that we call statistics? So that's what statistics, that is what statistics are. And then at the same time, the question is, can we generalize from that which we can observe to the broader class of objects from which our observations were drawn? And of course, that's statistical inference. So we spent a lot of time talking about it, a lot of time in one class meeting talking about this. Description, inference, the two major foci of statistical analysis. Continuing on with this, I tell people, statistics, and this is an idea I hit them with at the beginning of their two-course statistics sequence, but I've been hitting them with this at the beginning of the second course, and it still works then. I tell them, I think of statistics as involving four different tasks, and so the pathway through the course, this is a pathway through your introductory statistics courses, involves four things. So, first of all, description. Second of all, inference. Third, guiding decision-making. And fourth, assessing planes of causality. And I tell people, that's the roadmap for what you're going to get in a two-course statistics sequence. You're first going to learn about descriptive statistics, the nature of descriptive statistics, that distillation process of going from observed reality to a set of descriptive quantities. Inference, of course, the question of generalizing to the broader class of objects from those objects that we can just observe. Guide for decision-making, that's how we segue into hypothesis testing. So somebody makes an assertion about something, we assess the quality of that assertion, decide whether the assertion is plausible or not. So hypothesis testing, which is often one of the most difficult concepts to get across to people, that's how I try to put it within the context there. And then, of course, assessing claims of causality. Now, you know, people who are teaching modern causal inference methods, when they hear what I say about this, they cringe in the back of their hair, hair on the back of their neck goes up. But basically, this is my way of introducing regression models. You know, why do we use regression? We look for relationships between variables because having observed relationships between variables is one of the critical conditions for the existence of a causal relationship. And I keep emphasizing these four themes here, and almost every class, I refer to each of these four themes and tell people where we are in each of these four themes. So this is the first third of the class in the original, in the first session statistics class. This is the second third, you know, probability and then basic statistical inference leading into confidence intervals. This is the last few weeks, univariate hypothesis testing. And if I'm lucky, which I almost never am, which means I go a little bit slower than I usually think, we might get to two sample t-tests, but we never do by that point. So the first class ends here. The second class, which is the class that I'm getting ready to teach in the spring here, we start with this. But of course, to assess claims of causality, how do we do this? We construct models. Well, a model is a description of a relationship between variables, and we want to make inferences from what we observe to what is more, you know, the class of objects from which our observations were derived, and then we're going to test hypotheses about the components of those models. So it's a recursive process here. This set of four things recycles in itself through there. And I keep coming back to this. I keep harping on this and giving this as a theme so that people can see where we are in the class in the hopes that they don't get lost by the blizzard of new, you know, mathematical formulas and things like that that they're being hit with in here. Seems to work. Works for me, anyway. So I keep coming back to this just as a way of letting them know where we are and where we're going. My general approach for presenting class material is to be rigorous but relaxed. So, you know, I do not believe in cookbook statistics. I told you before, I certainly don't believe in defensive statistics or anything like that. I am not one of these people that believes you can learn statistics without formulas. This is a trend in the statistics education literature, and I think it's a very bad one. You don't have to use formulas to intimidate people. It's very important how you present formulas and explain what's involved in them, but you can't get around them. I mean, that's what statistical models are constructed with. So we can't, when I say rigorous, what I mean is we can't get away from the math. Well, we can take a pretty relaxed approach to the mathematics. You know, we can start not with, you know, the mathematician's approach of starting with a set of fundamental axioms and working out the derivations of those, although there's more of that than these people realize they're getting as we teach. But, you know, we can start with the substantive motivations and go from there and still be very rigorous about what we do.
I always make sure that the emphasis remains on using statistics to address substantive questions. And I make sort of a joke about this. You know, say, oh yeah, mathematical statisticians are intrigued by the beauty of the statistics themselves. And I, you know, make a joke about me being a geek. And I, you know, I'm sort of that way too about things. Multidimensional scaling models are my thing. Statistical graphics are my thing. I love these things intrinsically, but you guys don't want to be a geek like me. You're interested in this here. And, you know, it sort of lightens it up. And people like it that way. And it works pretty well, I think. But at the same time, I'm telling them, we're interested in dealing with substantive issues here. We're not statisticians. We're social scientists. We still have to be intimately familiar with these quantitative tools. You can't get around that. Early on in the class, whether it's that first semester class where I'm talking about summations and the properties of summations, or the second semester class where I'm talking about linear combinations and the qualities of linear combinations and the means and variances of linear combinations and covariance and things like that, I spend quite a bit of time on statistical nomenclature. So, you know, think of people who are intimidated by Greek letters. Now, it sounds kind of silly, but a lot of people are. So we spend a bit of time on the Greek letters we're looking at and explain why we use Greek letters, you know, differentiate parameters from statistics. And these Greek letters are just a different language for showing the letters you already know. Mu is just M, beta is V, sigma is S. So, you know, it's all, you know, you go through this stuff here to an extent that you're probably tired of hearing it yourself, but they're not. And they're picking this up here and getting it from you, and it really works out very well. Spent a lot of time talking about the properties of summations in the first semester course, the properties of expected values, expectations, and of course you can derive that for discrete variables from the properties of summations. In the second class, we spent a lot of time on linear combinations. I argue that a linear combination, understanding the nature of a linear combination, the mean and the variance of a linear combination, which at the same time helps me introduce the concept of covariance. And then, of course, when you introduce covariance, you can talk about correlation because it's just a transformation of the covariance. So you know, you sort of take the side door into these very sophisticated ideas here. And before these people realize it, they learn a lot more than they thought. And once they know what things like linear combinations are, well, we can start doing things like deriving the sampling variance of statistical estimators by showing that the regression coefficient, for example, is a linear combination of the observations. Well, you already know how to find the variance of a linear combination. Let's apply that here, and lo and behold, these people can follow me through the derivation, not just showing them a formula, but follow me through the derivation of the sampling variance for the regression overloss estimator. And I think it works. I think there are a lot of people who don't spend this time on the basic material at the beginning, and it reverberates later on in the class. I like spending a couple of days at the beginning on these things and then continually referring back to these basic tools, whether they're expected values, summations, or linear combinations, because they keep showing up in the material that we make. One of the things that I find important is I always want to avoid an atmosphere in which equations appear from nowhere. I mentioned this before. What I always try to do is give some foundation for where these equations come from. So, you know, what I'm doing depends on what the context is. So if we were in the introductory statistics class, for example, most people are pretty good at understanding the various measures of central tendency, but beginners always have trouble with understanding measures of dispersion. So I talk about, you know, properties. I go through, you know, a big spiel about we're trying to describe reality here. Well, we want to describe the distribution of observations. And we spend a lot of time talking about the distribution and this notion that there's a number line of possible values, and we want to determine, you know, how dense are observations at various points along this number line here. Well, we've talked about the central tendency, and central tendency is the, you know, if you had to pick one value that's the most typical value in your distribution, that would be the central tendency. And we talk about how this relates differently to means and medians and things like that, modes in certain cases as well. When we get to dispersion, you know, I say, okay, now we want to measure how wide this distribution is here. And first of all, we have to figure out what do we mean by the width of the distribution. And there are a number of different ways of thinking about the width of the distribution, or a dispersion in the distribution. One is the width of the distribution. Well, the width leads to this thing called the range of the distribution, a measure of dispersion. not a very good one because it's based upon the two most unusual observations in your entire distribution. So maybe we don't want the width of the whole distribution. Let's just take the width of the center of the distribution. Well, what do we mean by center? Well, let's take the centermost 50% of the observations, and that gives us this thing called the interquartile range here, which is probably a little bit better distribution, a measure of dispersion. And then still another idea. How about if we measure the average distance of an observation from the center of the distribution? And of course, we start talking about this and how if you use as your measure of center the mean, you can't just take the distance because that average distance will always turn out to be zero. So we square that average distance and we take the average of that squared average, we take the average of the squared distances, and lo and behold, suddenly we have the variance there. It takes a while to explain about degrees of freedom and why you divide by n minus 1 rather than n, but I have a story for that too. So, you know, you explain where things come from. In regression, the ordinary least squares formulas. You probably know the bivariate formula for the regression coefficient is the covariance divided by the variance of the independent variable. So this is why it's so important they know what a covariance is at the beginning, because where we're going to end up is this most important statistical quantity, the OLS slope coefficient, is a covariance divided by a variance. So if they already know what the covariance is, and I can assume that they have some notion of what a variance is, we're in great shape here. So how do I lead up to this? Well, the way I lead up to it is I say, okay, what we want to do is measure this linear relationship between these variables here. And the way I present that, the context in which I present it, is to say what we want to do is we have this cloud of points. We have a point cloud in the scatter plot. And if we've decided for ourselves that this scatter plot, or this point cloud, is roughly in the shape of a line, if it seems to display a linear pattern, then what we might want to do is put a line in the middle of that scatter plot such that the line comes as close as possible to as many of the points as possible. Does that make sense? And everybody in the class goes, oh, yeah, that makes sense. And I said, well, okay, let's start thinking about this. What do we mean by close? And we talk about various definitions of close, and then I get them to conclude with me that closeness should be measured in terms of the vertical distance from the points to that line. Okay, well, makes sense. It goes, yeah, that makes sense. Okay, let's get serious about this here. Let's see if we can start with a set of criteria for placing the line in the center, and let's see if we can come up with a formula to do it. So we decide for ourselves that any such line, if it really goes through the center of the point cloud, and by this point we've defined residuals. So as part of our ongoing discussion, we define the signed vertical distance as the residual. And I get them to agree with me that the sum of the residuals ought to be zero, because we want, you know, the positive distances to counterbalance the negative distances. Okay, everybody's fine with that. Well, gee, if it's, you know, it's going through the center of the point cloud, certainly it should pass through the point of means, what statistical graphics people call the centroid of the space. That's the point x bar, y bar. And we say, sure, of course. And then I say, well, you know, one of the other things is the correlation between the residuals and the x variable should be zero. And they're like, what? You know, where'd that come from? Well, then I can show them, using a handout, that if that's not true, then the line is tilted with respect to the point cloud. Everybody goes, well, okay, we wouldn't have thought about it that way, but now that you've shown us here, this makes sense. With those three conditions, and remember, they already know what linear combinations are, and they know what variances are, we can derive this formula to fit a line into the point cloud. And guess what? That formula turns out to be the covariance of x and y divided by the covariance of x. So it's the OLS formula, but we haven't found it yet. You know, this is just some formula that puts a line through the point cloud. That's all we get there. And then I say, well, this is one line, but how do we know it's the best line? How do we know it's the best line we could fit there? And everybody scratches their chin and says, well, I don't know. And I said, well, let's define what we mean by best. And of course, then we go through the big discussion and we end up eventually at the sum of squared residuals and minimizing the sum of squared residuals. And then this is where I start saying, okay, let's imagine a graph. Remember, I'm a statistical graphics guy, so I use lots and lots and lots of graphs. And I say, let's just imagine this here. We've got a three-dimensional graph. And on this three-dimensional graph, the two of the dimensions, which correspond, one dimension corresponds to the crack of the corner between the front wall and the floor. The other dimension corresponds to the corner between the side wall and the floor. The third dimension is the corner between the two walls there. This is the value of the slope coefficient. That's the value of the intercept there. This vertical dimension here is the value of the sum of squared residuals. Now, are you all with me that for each different value of A and B, we're going to end up with a different sum of squared residuals? And he goes, yeah, sure. And then we go through this whole business, the quadratic shape. Everybody finds that. Nobody gets terribly lost with that. And then I say, this is where calculus comes in. Now, we're not. This is where the guy started crying years ago. But I haven't had that happen. I don't know what it was in 1983 or whatever. But you know, I say, okay, we're not going to do calculus here. But you want to know what calculus does, and you know, you can certainly show people what a derivative is, and you know that it's nothing more than a slope for particular values of the independent variables, and they generally get it. And what we find, of course, is that the formula or the values of A and B that produce the minimized sum of squared residuals, those are exactly the same formulas that we came up with when we did our intuitive fitting the line to the point cloud. So we end up at the same place, but it's not a formula that drops from the sky. It's a formula that they and I have produced together, hopefully in each step being based upon a set of reasonable assumptions. And if anybody has questions about the assumptions, we stop and talk about it. And I haven't said it yet, but all of these things are backed up with copious numbers of handouts. So people have handouts that they can refer to. Like I said, I use lots of graphs. In many cases, I use statistical animations, so dynamic graphics that we show these things as well. And people seem to react pretty positively to them. Like I said, we explain the logic underlying statistical tools, and we show how these substantive considerations map onto the calculations of these various statistics here. There's another approach to statistics that says you should start with examples. Teach statistics by example. I'm only going to mention this briefly here because I don't do it, and I don't like that approach. Now, I can't say examples are bad. Certainly, examples are always good things. I'm not sure lots of different examples are what you should hit beginners with. Because the problem is, at least to me, to my mind, I mean, the logic behind this is it shows people the relevance and the broad applicability of statistical tools and statistical reasoning. So one of the last books that I used as the textbook for the introductory statistics class, in their most recent edition, each chapter started off with a substantive application. And I didn't like this very much, but I asked the students in the class at the end of the semester, what did you think? And they said, we hated it. You know, we got confused each time. Each one of these things was different, and we didn't know how it was relevant, how it applied. Well, I didn't feel good that they were confused and didn't like it, but I felt good because that's exactly what I was afraid of, and exactly what I was afraid of apparently was what was going on with this. I think, first of all, it's difficult to find pure examples. Real-life applications always involve complications. Complications are not what you want with beginners. You want nice, simple examples for beginners. At the same time, like I just said, you juxtapose substantive applications with new statistical concepts and new mathematics that they've never seen before. And to my mind, this is a recipe for disaster. People are, you know, that whole notion that all this stuff is hitting me and I don't know what's going on here, that's exactly what I'm afraid of there. So what I do is at the end of the presentation, I point people toward additional examples. You know, and tell them, we looked at a pure and simple version of this here. Of course, the real world is more complex. Go read these things, and you'll see where some of these additional complexities come in. But at the heart of it, they're not doing much different than what we did here. And again, as I said, it seems to work. What I like to do is start the class with a single substantive example. What I want is something to motivate the statistical material. And it's got to be reasonable. It's got to be readily comprehensible. While I teach primarily as political scientists, we get people from other disciplines, some very close, like sociology, but we also get a bunch of nursing students in our classes. And oddly enough, I never thought about this before, but interior design students. Interior designers apparently are now beginning to think that they are social scientists. And I don't say that disparagingly. I said it because I think it's kind of interesting. And it actually is part of the College of Social Science at Michigan State University, so they are sending their graduate students to us. So I want an example that is comprehensible to people who aren't, you know, specialists in arcane aspects of public opinion or anything like that. And, of course, I want it to be interesting and reasonable. And to compel interest, what I generally try to do is talk about conflict between two different theories. Talk about theories that compete with each other. So, for example,
In the regression class, one of my favorite examples, and once I find an example that works well, I stick with it for a long time, and this is one of these. Occupational prestige. You know, what makes some occupations more prestigious than others? Well, everybody understands that. It's not a difficult idea to get. You don't have to be a political scientist. You don't have to be a sociologist. And I say, okay, let's think about theories of occupational prestige. Well, one we might call the meritocracy theory. That the occupations that are more prestigious are those that require more knowledge to fulfill. In that case, the occupations that are most prestigious should be those that require the most education to enter that occupational category. That's the meritocracy theory. On the other hand, we have the materialistic theory. The most prestigious occupations are those that command the highest remuneration, highest compensation. You know, raw money is what does it. It's the occupations that get a lot of money. That's what creates prestigious occupations. So we have these two competing theories, the materialistic theory, the meritocracy theory, and this becomes my substantive motivation. How are we going to test these theories here? You know, well, of course, we need to get some data, but that's the example I can keep coming back to throughout the semester. This unifies, it provides a unifying theme for the whole class because we keep returning to this here, and I can, each time I bring up something new, relate it back to something they've already seen, that we've already talked about, and once again, it gives this sort of unifying path that they're following. It's not new stuff falling out of the sky, for the most part. What we, of course, need to do is keep reminding people that while we're looking at this one example here, the general principles of what we're doing can apply to lots of other things. And so I pepper lots of other examples like that in there as well. But my materialistic versus meritocracy story goes on and provides a centerpiece for most of what we're talking about. What's important is you've got to either obtain a data set or create one that can illustrate these theories here. And you want to use it for example calculations. You don't want it to be a big data set. Ideally, it's a data set that fits on one sheet of paper. So it's a relatively small data set because you want people to be able to do the calculations with it. You don't want it to be, overwhelming in terms of complexity or size. You want to make sure at the outset that this data set will have variables that illustrate or encapsulate each type of situation that's going to arise. That's where it gets tricky. These kinds of data sets are hard to find, and you sometimes have to be a little fast and loose and modify the real data. Modify, not cheat and change it, but that's basically what it sometimes entails. Of course, if you do that, make sure you issue the appropriate disclaimers so nobody takes your data set and goes out and writes some paper with it if they're using fake data. I've never had a problem with that, so it hasn't been a difficult thing. A lot of instructors create their data sets by doing a class survey. They pass a survey out to people on the first day of the class. That's fine. It's never worked for me. I haven't been happy with the results of that, but I know a lot of people who do it and a lot of very, very good instructors who do it. I think there are three ways to present statistical information. Again, I'm sort of thinking about the way I go through the classes here. Verbal language. This is good because people know what words are and you can use real world relevance. The bad part about verbal language is imprecise and it's got a very limited vocabulary. Second way of presenting statistical information, use math, use equations. Well, equations certainly are nothing if not precise and efficient, but they're unfamiliar and people are afraid of them. So those aren't the best things either. Another thing is pictorial language, use graphs, but the good thing is they're intuitive and aesthetically pleasing. The bad thing is it's sometimes hard to relate the graphs to the statistical quantities. So there are three different ways of presenting the same information. I try to put them all together and combine in my presentations all three of these presentation modes, and there's certainly good things about that. You increase the likelihood of connecting with somebody with each of these three things here. These different presentations highlight different things about the material, so you're giving more varied perspectives on the same kind of thing. It forces them to think about these different perspectives, so all those are good things, but there's some bad things with it as well. It takes a lot of time. You're not going to make as much progress as if you say, okay, we're going to do everything from an equation perspective, or we're going to avoid equations and do it all verbally here, which I've already said I don't like. There's also a problem that people might focus on the thing they like the best. Ooh, I like the graphs. I don't like those equations. Well, I like graphs too, but graphs and equations work together and they're each good on different things. Some people don't quite buy that. And then for the truly confused, presenting three different ways just gives them three different ways to get confused. And so, you got to keep in mind that this notion of different presentations has strengths, also has weaknesses with that as well. Very quickly, and I know I'm terribly running out of time, so I'm going to go through stuff a lot faster here to cut to the chase and get to the end. Computing. In the first class, I don't use the computer. This is, some people find this, you know, just awful that I don't do any computing at all. But in the first class, it's too easy for the software to become the focus of student attention. They pay attention to the software, they don't pay attention to the concepts. Have them use a calculator. Get a calculator, and of course, keep the data sets manageable, too. Do some of the intermediate calculations for them, but stay away from the computer and focus on the concepts. Even in the higher level classes, I begin with hand calculations. So remember, I talked about the linear combinations and the covariance, and we sit here and we derive the formula for the least squares coefficient. Well, that's all hand calculation, meaning with a calculator. More recently, I've told people we'll use the R statistical computing environment as a calculator to do this. So I don't want them to do the drudge work, but I don't want a software package doing all the work for them either. I want them finding these quantities. And then after that, they'll appreciate much more the use of the computer as a labor-saving device. In terms of the statistical software package, introductory level, if I were forced to use the computer, as I sometimes am in the introductory class, for example, last time I taught the introductory class was actually for the public policy program at MSU, and I'm married to the director of that program, so I do what she tells me, and she told me she wanted me to get into computing. So we used a point-and-click interface. There's actually a very nice software package called SysStat that has a nice point-and-click interface that we used for that. There's also a graphical user interface to the R statistical computing environment called the R Commander that, despite the intimidating nature of R, is actually fairly straightforward that I've used it in terms. But anything after the first course, I prefer the command line. Instruction in computing, I do one class session. So there's one class session that's a lab that introduces things. So we do one in-class basic introduction to whatever software package we're using. And at MSU, we sometimes use Stata, sometimes we use R. And I can go either way. But we do one class session, and then anything else we do in these optional lab sessions. And that tends to work out pretty well. But I always use handouts. So whenever we introduce a new concept in the class, these students are going to get at least one handout that shows them the computing aspects of what I've just introduced. So they're never lost. They never have to figure it out for themselves. They will always have an example that's if they want it on paper, that shows them what to do. Preparing lectures. You know, I do a lecture class, so you know, preparing lectures is a big thing. Always, always, always use a formal outline. Outline presentation organizes the material in a way that not only they can follow it, but I can follow it as I'm presenting it as well. I always begin with the substantive motivation, so we go back to our testing the materialistic versus the meritocracy theory and start with that. Then translate it. I think of it as a translation process. We translate from substantive statement of a problem, or statement of a substantive problem, verbal statement of the substantive problem, into a statistical concept that's manifested in mathematical form, in form of an equation or some particular statistical technique. Always provide calculation examples, obviously, but this is where a lot of people fall down. Work out your examples before class. We all laugh about this. I'm amazed how many people say, oh, I'll do it when I get into class and stand up in front of class. And then you stand up in front of class, and standing in front of a bunch of people to do this doesn't work. I don't know about, you know, I'm fairly relaxed in front of a class, and I still can't do it. So do all the work before the class, all of it. Keep the calculation notes. I like to keep the calculation notes separate from my substantive lecture notes. I write larger than I normally do. It's probably because of my eyesight, when I look down there, I want to see it really quickly. Keep your steps simple. Don't abbreviate steps. This will screw you up when you're trying to present things in front of the class. So I'm really, really serious with these calculation notes. Another practical aspect of this, the formal outline, the conceptual outline, those material, you can use this year after year after year. You know, refining it, presumably, as you learn more about teaching. But these calculation examples, you can change them each semester there. So that's another reason to keep these things separate here. These can exist independently of these. And I change these a lot, but once I'm happy with the way I do something, I keep that part pretty much similar.
I don't use PowerPoint. You know, the fact that I'm using slides here is very, very, very unusual for me. I don't do that. I think class sessions become too tightly tied to slides. I think it's too easy to stand up there and read off the slides, even if that's not what you think that you're doing. And I think it encourages a very, very passive presentation style. Edward Tufte, ex-political scientist who's done some work on graphical tools and things like that. In one of his most recent books has a chapter called The Cognitive Style of PowerPoint. And I take issue with a lot of things that Tufte does and says, but he's got it nailed on this one. PowerPoint is probably the most subversive tool for presentations that we've come up with in the modern age. I don't give out my class notes. You know, lots of people give out class notes, and I don't know if they're trying to ingratiate themselves with students or what, but that makes it just a little bit too easy for people to say, I don't pay attention, I don't have to go to class, all I have to do is look at the notes that he gives me. And it's not that I'm just trying to be mean or nasty about this, it's the fact that I really believe that the act of listening, assimilating, and writing down the information is part of the learning process. It works a lot better when you do it that way. And I've known people who've done it both ways, and they tend to agree once we do this. Problem is, once you have the PowerPoint slides, that becomes really easy. It's seductively easy to do that. What I do use is the blackboard, or the whiteboard, or the overhead, or whatever, and I want lots and lots of writing room. My favorite classrooms are those rooms in the physical science buildings where they have the sliding blackboards that you can move up and down, because I can fill every one of those blackboards. I come out of there with chalk all over me and everything,
Before we get to the advantages of it, be careful about writing. It's a lot different writing up here than it is writing on the paper, and I'm bad at writing on paper, so unless I watch it, I'm really worse up here. You got to be very careful about what you're writing, and you want to make sure that people understand what you're talking about. I had a student once who asked me about the ox that I keep writing about. I said, ox? What are you talking about? And what she was referring to was sigma with the X subscript. So she thought that was OX, ox. And so, be careful about how you write it there. I write material in short chunks. So when I'm going to do a formula, so for example, if I'm going to do the formula for the least squares coefficient, that's sum of X minus X bar, Y minus Y bar, divided by sum of X minus X bar squared. That's a lot to write up there. And so I tell them, okay, here's what I'm going to do. And I write down a little chunk and I say, okay, this is the sum of cross products here. Hang on, don't write it down yet. And then here, the numerator is the sum of squares in X. Give them little chunks and stop as you go through, and then tell them when you're done and tell them why you put it up on the board and tell them, now write it down. Now it's time to do this. So little chunks where you explain what you're doing as you do it, and then at the end, you tell them time to do it. And when you get done, tell them what you did. Recapitulate where you came from in terms of what you did. I think the blackboard, this approach here, it creates an active presentation style. Like I said, I'm walking all over the place and, like I said, getting chalk all over me, which my wife loves. It also slows down the presentation. As you probably figured out here, I talk fast and probably talk way too much. You can't talk quite as fast when you have to stop and write it down. So that's a good reason for me to use it, and they like it too. It gives me flexibility in the exact coverage. If I had to stick with a set of slides, I'd be lost. Because I you never know how people are going to react to things, and sometimes you want to stop and emphasize something perhaps a little more or perhaps a little less than you would have thought otherwise. On the other hand, there's some potential disadvantages of the blackboard. So handwriting, like I said, the ox lady for the sigma of X, you have to be very, very careful about that. There's the potential for dead air while you're writing up there. You know, nothing more boring than somebody standing up there writing like this and then standing back to make sure you did it properly. And, they're sitting out there getting ready to throw things at you and that sort of thing. And then worst of all, you start with the blackboard and, like I said, it provides flexibility, but this creates the potential to improvise or to ad lib, which is disaster. Don't ever do it. I mean, even now, without thinking about it, if we start in on this here, and no, you don't want to do that. You want to have everything down cold before you get into the classroom, or at least I do anyway, because I screw it up if I don't. Teaching tools in the classroom. Equipment for yourself. This sounds kind of silly. Writing implements, electric pointers, the computer and everything. Take it all. Think about what you need. I end up taking so much into the classroom with me, I have to make a little list for myself to make sure I've got everything before I go down to the classroom. So I don't have to go back up 3 flights of stairs to get from my office what I forgot to get before I went in there. Even worse when you're teaching in a different building than your office is in. So you want to have all the stuff with you. Always, always, always bring a calculator.
You know, if you inadvertently make a mistake in your notes, and I guarantee you will, you know, if that mistake involves something like a square root or something like that, I don't know about you, I can't do square roots in my head anymore. So having that little calculator thing there is a good thing, and I always make sure it's there. One of the most critical things in my class are handouts. I think handouts are something that students use, at least one each class, often many more than one. The handouts reiterate the major points of the class, they provide examples, it has some other advantages that we'll talk about. And like I said, I like to use animated presentations. These are dynamic graphics illustrating statistical examples. They show things like how assumptions affect models, how varying parameters affect model content. So that notion of how the derivative changes as you use different combinations of slope and intercept values there. Most important tool, your own demeanor, how you approach the classroom here. I can't tell you how much of an effect this has. I've known people who have had semesters where they have, you know, physical ailments. I know somebody who had a knee problem. Class that she taught all the time, got absolutely rave reviews, and was having a knee problem one session. And it was so bad she was in pain most of the time, but didn't want to say anything to the students in the class. But, you know, when you're in pain, you're not quite as animated. And certainly with a knee problem, you can't be walking around as much as you were before. It was amazing how the teaching evaluations reflected that during that year. So the way you present yourself has a very, very important impact. And what I think, I don't tell jokes very well. I know people who are real comedians when they get into the class and so on. I gave up on that a long time ago. What you want to do is show that you're excited and interested about what you do. Enjoy what you do, and other people are going to enjoy it too. But the thing is, this is going to be real. I mean, you really do have to enjoy this stuff. You can't fake this. You can't get up there and be superficial or anything like that, because they'll pick up on that right away. It's just another example that love what you do and you'll do it well, or the chances are that you'll do it well. Be mindful of your classroom setup. When I say that setup is, I generally have a table in front of me. I try to find rooms that have a table and a podium. The podium, because my eyesight is such that it's easier for me to see things like that. But know where your stuff is. And I have, you know, handouts. I've got pointers. I've got different colored, if it's a whiteboard, I've got different colored markers to play with on there. I'm bad enough with even white chalk, so I don't try different colors of chalk or anything like that. But make sure that you're standing up there and you know where everything is. You don't fumble around, unless you want to, you know, produce the image of the absent-minded professor or anything like that. Certainly be familiar with the computing equipment and the projection equipment. Nothing worse than showing up and having your you know, main exhibits inaccessible. And what you want is to be able to segue from one thing to the next without, again, a lot of dead air there. Each lecture, I follow a regular progression. I try to explain the topic, show how it relates to the big picture, introduce new ideas, and at the end of the class, explain where you came from. So this is what we're going to do, this is what we're doing, and this is what we've just done over and over again. Fairly repetitious, but they like it. Handouts here, like I said, at least one handout for each major concept helps people a lot. I think the full set of handouts, which in my case is usually pretty thick. With handouts, I try to summarize things here, tedious calculations and so on, but handouts are not substitute slides. I generally don't want handouts to provide complete coverage of anything. I don't want people using handouts as substitutes for thinking. I want handouts to support what I do, not substitute for what I say in the classroom. Because of physical objects, people like to have something they take away, and the handouts are that. The course website, resource, I tell them this is an absolutely critical resource. Everything is on the website, from course location, my contact information, the syllabus, all of the handouts, the lecture outlines, and all of the computing resources are up there as well. We're getting toward the end, so I apologize, I'm going on a lot longer than I thought. I don't assign a research paper. I think research, there just isn't enough time to do this. I do emphasize that, you know, you're not going to learn it unless you apply this stuff. I talk about statistical work as a translation process, producing a mathematical representation. What I do is, rather than a research paper, I give lots of homework assignments, at least one a week, some more than that. Some of them are pure calculation, but most of them ask people to apply the concepts that we look at. When they hand the homework in, it's reviewed and corrected, but we don't grade it for content. They don't get grades on their homework. What I do is tell people, this is your chance to get it wrong here. And of course, we hope you're going to see why you got it wrong. You know, we hope you aren't going to get it wrong in the first place. But if you do, no problem. This is where you find out about that when we get it corrected so that you know how to do it right the next time. So the other thing that's critical to emphasize is that people should work neatly and show all their work. This sounds like primary school math class, but believe me, when you're trying to grade exams, that's absolutely critical there. On exams, I use two or three exams, usually more exams in lower level courses, fewer exams in higher level courses. In the regression class, and when I teach the maximum likelihood class, the final exam is take home an open book. I don't do that in the first semester course. The content of the exams is cumulative. You know, somebody else says, is the exam cumulative? Well, yes, but not because it's cumulative. You know, I like to torture you with this. It's the subject matter. You can't do what we're doing now unless you already knew what we did before. My exams include two types of questions. I usually put three short answer questions and three or four longer calculation questions, maybe a derivation or a simple proof. That's more to convince them they can do it than anything else. Again, you can overcome this, oh, I don't like math and I won't use math for anything. Grading the exams, what I do and what I think is absolutely critical is strive for consistency in grading. Strive for consistency more than correctness in the grading. The reason I say that is, even if you get something wrong in grading, if you're consistent, you got it wrong in everybody's. And so there's not going to be any idiosyncratic bias in the grades that people receive. So what I do is I begin by writing out my feelings about what a perfect answer is. Then I evaluate each student's performance relative to my perfect answer. And I try to determine on each question how many points being points on the exam, are associated with each component of the perfect answer, and I grade accordingly with that. I go over the exam in detail, ideally in the next class, if I can get them graded. If not, it's a bit later than that. And tell people, you know, okay, here's this question here. Here's where a lot of people lost a few points on this question. And here's why, and explain it explicitly, and you get a lot fewer complaints that way. Not no complaints, but fewer than you would otherwise. I always, always use a curve to assign grades. The numeric score on the exam, remember, the numeric score comes from comparing their answer to the perfect answer. Well, nobody's perfect. Not even I'm perfect. I tell them, if I were taking my own exam, I wouldn't get a perfect score on it. You know, exams are artificial situations in a certain way. So if you don't match up to perfection, don't feel so badly about it. What you get instead is a letter grade that compares each person's standing relative to the overall class distribution. That's what you pay attention to. And of course, everybody hopes they're on the high end of that. But it doesn't eliminate complaints, but in my case, it seems to minimize them. Okay, last thing, and you've been also very, very patient while I've been talking a lot here. Some online resources for teaching, some of which you may already know about. This is one, Steve and I were talking about it before the session here. This is a relatively new one called Possum, named after a cute little animal. The online portal for social science education and methodology. I'm actually the co-PI on the project that generated this here. This is intended to be an online wiki, a sort of open-ended resource open-ended resource materials for teachers of quantitative methods in social sciences. So it's just getting started now. There are various things like course syllabi, some data sets. There are blogs up there, discussion groups, much like the forum that Steve talked about here. Hopefully it's going to keep growing and people are going to get involved in it, but it's really at the very early stages at this point. In the American Statistical Association, there is a group called the Committee on Advancing Undergraduate Statistical Education, or CAUSE, and they have a website called causeweb.org. And this is accessible even to people who are not members of the ASA. They have lots of teaching resources there, both from discussions of various teaching techniques and things like that, to data sets and all kinds of other things as well. A nice group of people, too, very, very helpful. There is a group at Rice University, and there are actually a number of different people at different locations that seem to have converged on Rice University as a location for it. It's their virtual online statistics education center that has now coalesced into a website called onlinestatbook.com. There are various other resources at Rice, but they all seem to be gathered into this this website here. And there's all kinds of neat stuff on there, from statistical animations to sample problem questions and things like that. Something I've found very useful over time is something called the Data and Story Library, or DASL. It's exactly what it says. It gives substantive stories and data sets that you can use to provide examples for this. There was actually another version of DASL composed of Australian examples. It seems to have disappeared from the web. I can't find it anymore. But the original DASL is still up there. And I actually use this on homework exams and homework assignments and things like that. So very, very helpful. And then this is a general resource that it's part of the American Statistical Association, but it's written for practitioners, so it's not all mathematical statistics. There's a lot of good practical advice in here, the Journal of Statistics Education. So lots of other resources. These are the ones that I find helpful. So again, I talked far longer than I should have here, but I certainly appreciate your patience and your willingness to listen to me.